it's an interesting fact. You know, last week we mentioned there was the Ravid the second and Ravid the third, been long erased here. Ravid two and Ravid three, and Ravid two is Ravid three's father-in-law, which is an interesting, confusing historical fact. That's just life. Now, what's interesting is both were Mekubalim. Both were known Kabbalists. Now, we know very much that the Rambam was very much not a Mekubal. We know the Rambam was not a Mekubal. He's, you know, people in the world at large like to talk about conflict or differences between Kabbalists and rationalists. Personally, that's, as I mentioned at the end of last week's shiur, that is oversimplification, because there is definitely some common ground, and more than you would think. On the other hand, there's more or less no question at all, and I'm not even sure if I'm going to mention it later, so I'll mention it now. There is the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel would. Don Yitzchak Abarbanel, who lived, let's say, I'm going to estimate now. He's in the early Achronim, not in the
Abarbanel was 1500.
The Abarbanel died around 1505, not later than 1510. The Abarbanel does quote a supposed letter in which the Rambam. Which claims, supposedly a letter of the Rambam claiming that the Rambam at the end of his life saw the Kabbalah and retracted much of his rationalist philosophy. Now, the reason why one finds that hard to believe is, as we mentioned last week, the Rambam has a letter written to Ibn Tibbon about translating Marn Avruchim, which is dated by the Rambam 4 years before his death. And in that letter, it's very clear that the Rambam has not changed his approach in Marn Avruchim. So I find it, you know, to say hard to believe is not like strong enough statement. It's an anonymous letter, you know. The Abarbanel does quote it. One wonders if the Abarbanel was in possession of that other letter of the Rambam. And if I remember, I'll try to, you know, track down. Because, you see, most of the letters of Rambam, we might more or less know when they were known. It sort of feels like that, the letter of the Rambam that I'm quoting, the Abarbanel was not aware of. But I'm not, that needs, hopefully I won't forget to, you know, like do the legwork to see if that's true. Now, but what's most interesting about this, now, so now we have the Ravid's father-in-law, and we're going to see some other people in a moment, in a little while, who are definitely Mekubalim. No one doubts they're Mekubalim. We have the Rambam, who's rational.
Doesn't specifically mean he was against the Kabbalah.
Okay. You know, you're asking an interesting question. That's an interesting question. You're asking, why is it...
He might just not be a Kabbalist.
Okay. That's a hard... There seems to be an assumption in the world... And the world at large, and I don't just mean academic world, I mean world Jewish thought, that there's conflict between these two approaches. And I already said that I think it's overstated. I agree. But this by nature, see, the Rambam's, as I like think we saw through the Rambam Shirim, the Rambam is really complicated. The Rambam, like, people love taking one Rambam out of context and trying to make something out of it. And it's just, it's like the Rambam's a system. Don't you know? You have to.
Rambam.
Maimonides. He's a big system, and you have to. You don't really understand all of a system until you get it. And the Rambam himself warns people about it constantly throughout his sermon. The most clear and open one is when in the end of his Akdamak Zechelok, he says, "Go over Chazar over what I've written here many times." And if you review it once, or even ten times, and you think you understand what I'm talking about, Hashem knows you're fooling yourself. So the point is that the Rambam's complicated. The Rambam knew he was complicated, And okay, whatever. Anyway, there is certain points of conflict, which I think we mentioned some of them. I mentioned one of them, I think, last week. I think it was last week, about Trias and Mason. Last week we mentioned there is definite clear machlokas on how to learn Trias and Mason, on with Tria, the Rambam. I didn't like go through the whole sheet of the Rambam because that would be mamash, a proper Rambam shir. Instead of spending 4 weeks on the Rambam, we have to spend like half the year on the Rambam, and that's like too much. So there is a clear point of argument about how to understand final status of man. The Rambam understands it's neshama bliguf, it's a soul without body, and the Mukabalim understand it includes a body. The Rambam's deeply bothered at what you need a body for, and it's, the Mukabalim have answers to that, have clear answers to that, what you need a body for, but yeah, not now. Now, but what's interesting is that even though the Ravid starts his hasagos, his critiquing of the Rambam, literally in the Rambam's preface to Mishneh Torah, he starts critiquing the Rambam in his preface. When the Rambam says he thinks he's clarified Torah, and you want the Ravid says, you didn't clarify anything. We can't figure out where the Rambam got everything he's saying from. He didn't make things more clear, he made it less clear. So, you know, the Ravid doesn't, you know, the Ravid Tequila didn't let the Rambam, he didn't let the Rambam get a page down without a comment. However, fascinatingly, in the first four prakim of Hilchas Yesod HaTorah, where the Rambam definitely diverges into Kabbalah, and that caused a lot of controversy later on by others.
Into philosophy, and
that's like one of those obvious mistakes I make that you're supposed to figure out. It's like, you know, when I call a kid by the wrong name, you know, it's the same thing. Okay, yeah, the Rambam takes a digression into explaining the basics of philosophy. The Ravid doesn't make one comment.
On
Trias HaMesim, as the Rambam himself said, now, see, on the Shittas HaRambam of Neshama Malgruf, he doesn't comment either. Interestingly, on the mistake that people thought the Rambam didn't mention Trias HaMesim, the Ravid was too much of a scholar to make such. It's mostly Amaratzim. It doesn't appear that anyone of stature really thought the Rambam doesn't mention Trias HaMesim, because as the Rambam says, he does mention Trias HaMesim
in the 13 Ikar.
Yeah, in the 13 Nikarim. I mean, like the Rambam, as I said, you know, whatever. So it's just a fascinating thing. The Rambam does not bother commenting on these obvious, on the most obvious places where you think the Ravid would blast the Rambam. The Ravid doesn't blast the Rambam. So that's food for thought, and I just want to go on a little.
And so in philosophy, and what was the other one?
In philosophy, he didn't, and also when the Rambam's approach to Trias HaMesim, which is based on the Rambam's philosophical approach, rationalistic approach, the Ravid doesn't bother, you know, the Ravid is no comment. That's where the Ravid says no comment. Okay. Okay. Now, it's a fascinating thing that I'm pointing it out because I see it rather than, you know, saying anything substantial about this. But it is definitely a fact. It's definitely a fact that the first place that we clearly see clear, open reference to Kabbalah is in Provence, in the Ravid's area. That's the first place we see it. Let's go on a little before, you know, that is definitely the first place we open and clearly see it. There is a lot of debate/question, etc., I mean, amongst traditional scholars, which Rishonim had the Kabbalah and which didn't. Rabbeinu Bechai definitely did. That's open. The Rabbeinu Bechai quotes Kabbalah straight. We're going through this. We're like, this is more of a history class than a hashkafa or a machshava class. So I'm going historically, and I'm leaving next week, Be'ezer Hashem. I'm pretty sure, it depends how much we got done this week, but I'm pretty sure next week, if not, it's going to be definitely be the week after, we can get to Ramosha de Leon and the appearance of the Zohar. We're going to get there in not more than 2 weeks. Maximum 2 weeks. So that's when we're going to talk about the, we're not going to be able to talk about everything now, even though it's interesting. Because it's only a week or two off, you know. Like, come on, let's be patient. Okay. Academics claim, and I'm sure we're aware of that, or at least some of us are aware of that, that the provincial Rishonim invented Kabbalah. That the academics claim.
That what?
The academics claim that provincial Rishonim invented the Kabbalah. From Provence.
Oh.
Provincial. Provence. That's what they claim.
French Rishonim?
Provincial. Southern France is called Provence. Should I write it on the... I'll write it on the back.
Rishonim.
Provence. That's how it's written.
Southern
France. Okay, that's what they claim. Now, I'm going to get again to really to deal with the most critical part of this is when we're going to discuss the Zohar. So stay tuned. But you have to understand the entry card to the academic world is that you do not accept authenticity of Torah Sinai. It's that Masara Satara, etc., etc. That is the entry card to the academic world. You cannot be part of the academic world and hold differently. That's just a fact. Okay. One of the Sifrei Kabbalah, known Sifrei Kabbalah, is called Sefer HaBahir. Sefer HaBahir.
How do you spell it?
Bahir is spelled...
This is
an Sefer.
This is known before the Zohar?
Yes. How about here?
Hold on,
the Zohar? Okay, you'll wait. I don't want to talk about the Zohar yet. We can talk about the Zohar either next week or the week after. Sefer HaBahir.
Is what?
Sefer HaBahir. What is it? Okay, now, this, I have it downstairs. Maybe I should have, if I brought it in, maybe I should even brought it up to read you the quote. Now, I'm actually so amused by it, I can't resist quoting it. I mean, or basically quoting it. So I have this book that This is it's a textbook. It's not, you have to understand, and I think I mentioned this here. There's a difference between textbooks and real articles. The real history is not in the textbooks. Real historical research is not in the textbooks. Real historical research is in the professional articles written in journals. That's where it is. That's a fact. I'm telling you now, where the real history is researched, et cetera, it's in the journals, it's not in the textbooks. Textbooks, by force, have no choice but to somewhat oversimplify, and sometimes not just somewhat oversimplify, sometimes grossly oversimplify facts, that definitely the professor who wrote the textbook is very aware that he's oversimplifying. Now, depending on how much he knows about the topic and how out of his depth he is about that topic, he may be aware that there are even slight distortions in the oversimplification. But anyway, whatever it is. Okay, so this is a quote about Sefer HaBahir, which I find amusing. I really find this amusing. They're unable to figure out, A, when the Sefer they believe was written. That's A. It's attributed, it's the Ramban in Chumash. The Ramban in Chumash constantly quotes it as Midrash Drubya, I'll find a quote for you quickly. I don't have a Ramban here. The Ramban quotes Sefer HaBahir in Chumash many times. From the Chonya ben Akana. From the Chonya ben Akana. That's who, that is the...
Who he puts in the period of the Amorite?
Tanoi. According to the traditional approach, Rabbi Nachman ben Akana.
Was written thousands of years ago.
Ben Hakana was written about 100.
So why is it only brought up now?
Look. What do you mean? Why is it only brought up now? Yeah, let me just see what I'm doing. All midrashim are written by Tanoim. That's a fact. Not for Tanoim. Tanoim are early Amoraim.
You don't take them literally, do you?
When do we take a midrashim literally and when don't we? That takes a lot of eon. There's machlokas rishonim and achronim about it, and there's some who, again, the Rambam takes more agadotas, not literal. But if you think the Rambam discards all agadotas as metaphorical, allegorical, you're just dead wrong, and that's quite quantifiable.
Didn't the Rambam say if you say all of them, you're...
That's popular legend. That's not mamash a quote from the Rambam.
Is that a quote from anybody?
It's definitely a quote, a Chassidish quote. Definitely Rabbi Dr. Professor A.J. Tversky does say something on those lines.
Abraham
J. Tversky. He's written like 35 books or so. You've heard of him?
Yeah.
Psychiatrist, not psychologist.
Psychiatrist. Do we know who attributed to him?
I'm not sure. Okay. Now, again, so academics, as I said, axiomatically, assume that this was ki'ilu, invented, plagiarized by somebody, by unknown provincial scholar, and sometime between 1050 and 1150. They don't understand the Sefer well, don't understand it has an unclear structure, an unclear purpose. So you know what that is? Intellectual honesty would say, I don't really understand this topic at all, and I should desist from comment. Now, as we know, it's very hard for Jews not to comment. That's a known fact. Jews love commenting. So I'm commenting on the comment that it was intellectual honesty and humility was called for, and it's... If you admittedly can't figure out A, who wrote it, B, what it's about, C, its structure, then the fact that you could understand a small amount of it was really should tell you that you don't really understand any of it, because that's just how things are. It's as I say. I tell you guys the story of my father's old astrology books.
No.
Okay, here's a story. Okay. My father, as you may be aware... So as you may know, my father worked for NASA for a solid 25 years. He's worked with NASA for around 40 years or so. When he went to college back in the 50s. And he had a couple of his astrology books... about the galaxy, et cetera, hanging around the house. So I was one time, flipping through them, and I read the following chapter. I read a chapter about life on Mars. Life on Mars. Okay? Life on Mars. So this quotes a number of major scientists back in the 50s and had made hundreds, if not even thousands, of observations. The polar pack, the changing polar pack, and this, that, the next, before we got to Mars. There was one picture we had of Mars. There a lot of proof that there Bukhara is enough change going to the surface of the planet that would seem to indicate there has to be life. Because if not, in other words, you can't. The fact that you could see change to the ground, that you could observe change to the ground of the planet via the telescope, that seems to show there has to be some type of life there.
No.
They were able to observe changes in color changes in the surface, and clear, the polar area increased and decreased seasonally. And it could be there was one or two other proofs also, and these are based on a lot of observations. This is what I say is like this. And the first time I did this here, I was in the classroom that overlooks Mechalah, and I didn't realize it. So I said, if we would take a binocular and look in a room in that building over there, and the guys all burst out laughing. Because I was pointing at Mechalah. So if we would take a binocular and look, if you take a binocular and look in a building, whatever, unnamed building, and we don't know what it is, and we could sit there and mark down our observations for 3 years straight, looking through someone's window, we could come up with a lot of interesting theories and deductions. But trust me, if we walk into the room and look around, we'll have an infinitely better picture of what's going on. So that's what's going on over here. You know, it should be clear that if you understand a very small percentage and you don't understand structure, purpose, and who the author is, that means you know so little you should keep your mouth shut. You don't really know enough to say anything. There's nothing wrong with saying, I don't know. Rashi says, I don't know many times.
That's so, very Jewish.
I'm Jewish, no?
You're a minority.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, so that the point is over here. I really feel that intellectual humility was called for, and unfortunately it wasn't. Okay, now the facts are that the Ramban quotes Sefer HaBah here from Chani ben Akana extensively throughout Chumash. It's an interesting thing. I'm not sure about this, but I have noticed that the Ramban gets a lot of credence and respect across the boards. And I'm Amish, definitely in the Jewish world, regardless of which part of the Jewish world you're in, you know, all across the spectrum, everyone gives the Ramban a lot of respect.
Why?
I'm not sure. You know what? No, I'm not sure.
Maybe it's because of the debate?
Maimonides?
Nachmanides. The Rambam, some people, and certain parts of the spectrum, people say, oh no, we don't hold like the Rambam. On Mukubalim, some people think, no, we don't hold like Mukubalim. Now, the Ramban gets universal respect, which I'm somewhat puzzled by. I'm not sure why. It doesn't bother me. I'm just puzzled how the Ramban gets the universal respect. I know the Gaon, the Vilna Gaon, gets universal respect also, which I'm sort of puzzled by also. But the reason why the Gaon gets universal respect is Gretz.
Is what?
Gretz. You've heard of Gretz? Gretz was the father of Jewish history.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
Heinrich Gretz, yes. Gretz was very enamored with the Gaon. And I've seen things written. Gretz is like
Stony.
Early modern. And even though he was definitely not Orthodox, on the other hand, he was definitely not assimilationist. Definitely not. He's very enamored with the Gaon and the Gaon's genius, etc., etc. Now, what's fascinating is I've even seen Jewish history books written by assimilationist Jewish historians or very close to assimilationist Jewish historians, and they're also like I read very positive perek, very positive chapter about the Gaon. I was like, what is going on? So then I noted his footnotes that like most of the chapters quoted from Gretz. I said, ah, that's it. When in doubt, assume people are quoting Gretz.
Well, is it true about the Gaon learned Kabbalah?
The Gaon was an immense mekubal.
That's known.
That's a known fact. Everyone knows that. Gretz knows that, and everyone knows that. The Gaon wrote as more on Kabbalah than he wrote not on Kabbalah. But okay, whatever. We'll go on a little more. Now the point over here with the Ramban is a similar thing.
Question.
Yeah.
You probably gave a Shem Kabbalah.
No.
What? I mean, you never
give
a Shem Kabbalah.
No. What it is? We can talk about it a little more next week, the week after. Yeah, I should put a sign up.
Put it on. You're more of a lich box.
I'm not. I never doubted. I really say I'm really American. I'm really American. My grandpa, all my grandparents, if they weren't born in America, they grew up from a very young age in America, spoke unaccented English.
Now yours, right?
Okay. You know, that's like the great irony is my oldest son is technically not Israeli.
He's really Israeli.
But he's really Israeli.
Yeah.
Now, it's again, everyone agrees that the Ramban is quite an authority. And the Ramban, you know, when it comes to Torah, no one doubts the Ramban's competency. And it's just, Pashut, it's in my opinion, beyond preposterous to think that the Ramban would have been fooled by a forgery which wasn't more than 100 years before him, 150 years before him. You don't, we're going to talk about that more, Be'ezer Hashem, next week, I believe. But I'll be able to tell pretty soon how far, because I see how much more we have done. So let's go on a little more. So, yeah, let's go on. I'm not going to tell you much more about the Sefer. I never tried to learn it, so I can't really tell you much about it. I know the Ramban does quote it. I think some of it I do feel I had some very basic understanding of, but a lot of it I felt like so out of depth, my depth, that I'm not even going to claim to understand it. Okay. Because now we're in Provence, around the times of the Rambam, we're going to go through the Kimchis. The Kimchi was a big family. We know the most famous one is the Radak, Rab David Kimchi. He's the most famous one. And if you go, anyone who is ever in my night seder definitely has heard of the Radak.
Is there still descendants of Kimchi today?
There absolutely not only are descendants, I personally know descendants of Kimchi.
When did he live? When did the Radak?
Okay, let's go back though.
Who's Kimchi?
Yeah, Kimchi. The yes. The Radak's father's name, Reb David Kimchi. The Radak, David Kimchi. The Radak's father's name, we're going to start out with the Radak's father, Reb Yosef Kimchi. Reb Yosef Kimchi, and he is abbreviated for some reason as Rikam. That's how he's called. If you want to refer to him, he's called Reb Yosef Kimchi. Why is he going to be called the Rik? Because there's an Achron who's called the Maharik. That's probably why, or you could think it's Rabbi Yosef Karo.
Right.
So, in order to see that it's Kimchi, he's Rikam. He lived around 1100 to 1170. That's when he lived. He actually said, my date's at 1105.
Okay.
1105. Yeah, around, a little before the Rambam.
Now,
the Rambam was 1135. Rashi passed away in 1105. 1135 to 1204 is the Rambam.
I gotta get
the Imamish, it's very important to have Rashi.
Born where?
Rashi?
Rashi was born around when?
Rashi's 1035 to around 1105.
I thought it was
1040 to 1105. Okay. Fine. So there's Rabbi Yosef Kimchi was the father. He died in 1170. The older son was Ramoshe Kimchi, who is called Ramak. Now, that's interesting. Ramoshe Cordovo was also called Ramak, but we don't care, and we just call both of them Ramak. And he was...
He can't
overlap the Maharik. Yeah, 1130 to 1170, to 1200. Sorry, 1130 to 1200. Now, the Radak...
1135?
No.
31.
No, look at this. 1160.
What?
1160 to 1230 to 1235. Ah, 1235. Okay. Which leads me to believe that the Ramak, the Ramoshe Kimchi, and Reb David Kimchi did not have the same mother. It's not mukrach. I don't have any substantial proof for it. I actually have a book at home that I need to look in to see, because I have an academic book at home that I need to look in and see if he comments. But the 30-year gap between Ramoshe Kimchi.
You said he was 43.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
Ramoshe Kimchi. It should say 1200, not 1170. 1200. The father died in 1170. The father died in 1170. Just wait a second, y'all. Father died in 1170. The Radak was 10. The Radak was raised by his older brother. He was raised by his older brother. Fascinatingly, the Radak extensively quotes his father in Tanakh, and very, very rarely his brother. Now, we know the most famous one was the Radak. He is the most famous one, and the reason why is because he wrote his parish on Tanakh. He wrote his parish on Tanakh, and it's absolutely indispensable. In other words, we have Rashi. There were some other Rishonim who attempted to write on Nach, on Nevi'im. Mm-hmm. They were Kaspi. Other ones, they didn't. Ibn Bilam.
The mom was like
1980. The mom died in the 1880s.
Yeah,
the mom.
The
Malbim's, I'm telling you right now, the Malbim's accomplishment is astounding. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky said that the Malbim was considered, in Europe, was considered one of the greatest. The Rabbanim held, he was Meir Leibush ben Yechiel Milchel. The Malbim was considered one of the most brilliant people, Rabbanim, alive in his day. And the fact that if his parish, if we wouldn't know what it was from, if you look at the Malbim, if you look in the Malbim, he looks like he's 200, 300 years before he was.
Yeah,
he's unbelievable. And the more I've worked on it, the more respect I give the Malbim for his exegetic prowess. We do him a little. He's wordy, and it would take too long.
Who's wordy?
The Malbim.
The who?
Malbim.
Most people in his time were.
He's not. You're right. He's less verbose than Rav Shimshon Fol Hirsch, for example. But okay, whatever.
What's the Radak
authored his commentary on Nach. He did write on Torah also. The only part of Torah we have is on Brachos. You can get it in Sfarim stores, Adi Yom Hazeh, even on Brachos. It's in the Torah Chaim of the
Sefer or
Parsha?
Sefer.
It's in Torah Chaim, the Masorah of Kook, Mikros Kedalos. Of course, what he's really famous for is his parish on Nevi'im, all of Nevi'im, and I don't want to say the most important parts, but much of Ksuvim, which is Tehillim, Divrei Hayamim, and Mishlei. Now, Mishlei, truthfully speaking, cannot be gotten unless you know how to find it. And I once spent months searching for it, because when I was learning Mishlei originally, like 15 years ago, I spent months searching for it until I finally found it. What?
For
the Radak on Mishlei?
Maybe he's not in the Mikros Kedalos?
No, he's not.
Why?
Because the Radak is what Kielu, the basic counter Mefaresh to Rashi. There's Rashi, like in Chumash, you have Rashi in the Ramban, in Navi you have Rashi in the Radak. In Mishlei, I felt that needed something there. And so I looked and finally figured, yeah, whatever. I really personally found the Me'iri on Mishlei to be, and the Me'iri is very verbose. The Me'iri just doesn't stop.
Me'iri didn't get back from the Vatican.
No, the Me'iri was not from the Vatican. The Me'iri was from.
Was
it the Karavaniza,
no?
No, it was not the
Karavaniza. It was discovered.
No, the Me'iri was first. That's not really accurate. The Me'iri is quoted by the Shitak Gumbetzis extensively in Baba Kama, and not as extensively in Baba Metzia. So the statement that the Me'iri was an unknown before, let's say, 1840 or so, is not true. I don't want to spew it out. Just wait a second. You want me to look it up? Can't resist saying this. I'm not going to torture you that badly. Because there are those people who claim that there's only one source for the Me'iri, and therefore try to cast, doubts on the halachic weight the Me'iri should have. Now, that's a different issue that Imam is not going to talk about now. But the statement that it all comes from one Ksaviyat is not true, because, A, as I mentioned already, Baba Kama is extensively quoted in the Shita. Extensively. And Baba Metzia, there are quotes in the Shita also. And Shabbos, there's at least in Shabbos, there's a second Ksav Yad. at least in Shabbos. And obviously there was an earlier second Ksaviyad on Baba Kama, because it's impossible to tell me that Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi, if he would have had the entire Me'iri as Rav Kapach said, I don't know if you guys have heard of Rabbi Kapach? Kapach. Kapach. Okay, Rav Kapach, he died about 10 years ago. He's from the old generation from Teman. And he writes somewhere that his father told him that whenever he sees a Ksav Yad he's never seen before, he must copy two copies of the entire Ksav Yad over immediately. Manuscript. So that was what was done pre-printing press. In other words, in Yemen, they were working only partially with the printing press until they came to Israel, more or less. And a lot of things in Yemen were done by Ksav Yad until, 1950. So because of that, there are Midrash and Midrash HaGadol and a number of others which are only, they were in Yemen just in Ksav Yad until as little as 60 years ago. And they had a Kabbalah, a real tradition of how to deal with Kisvei Yad. And that's why I'm quoting Rav Kapach as saying, when you find a Ksav Yad, quoting his father, when you find a Ksav Yad you've never seen, the first thing is you have to make two copies of it. So I assume Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi would have used the same approach. And if he would have found the Beis HaBechira, the Me'iri's parish on Shas, which is what's in, I can't remember the name of it was found in a monastery in, I believe, northern Italy. But it's a copy of everything. So if Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi had that Ksav Yad, he would have copied everything. He wouldn't have just copied Baba Kama and part of Baba Tzir. So obviously he had a different Ksav Yad, which is really not that much of a chiddush, but not for now. Okay, Vajra. Okay, back to France. Let's get one more piece done. Back to France. Okay, now we're going to talk about Tosus Evru and the Tosus Rabbi Yehuda from Paris and Rabbi Chil from Paris. The Tosus Evru.
Evru,
yeah. Yeah, I'll spell Ivra. Ivra in Hebrew. Here's how it's spelled in Hebrew. It's spelled Aleph, Yud, Beis, Resh, Aleph. And in English, it's spelled E-V-R. It's French, so, E-U-X.
Well, of course. Why don't we throw Q in there also?
Yeah, that's French. I asked a Frenchman if there are any rules about when you pronounce the last letters or not. And he said, there are none. So just do it.
Versailles has like five extra letters.
Yeah, no. Okay, whatever. Anyway, Ivru, the Tosus Ivru, and the Tosus, the Bali Tosus, and Rabbi Yehuda from Paris, and Rabbi Yechiel from Paris. Rabbi Yehuda from Paris lived 1166 to 1224, and he was succeeded. He had a yeshiva in Paris, and he was succeeded by Rabbi Yechiel from Paris, who lived 1190 until 1268. Yeah, he was not his son. Rabbi Chil from Paris was not the son of Rabbi Yehuda from Paris. They just were the two Rosh Yeshiva.
What was Rabbi Yehuda's last name?
He died in 11. First time, Rabbi Yehuda is 1166 to 1224. And Rabbi Chil from Paris is 1190 to 1168. Now, I'm really somewhat, confused why this is true, but the Tosus Ivru, who flourished, as they would say, from, let's say, around 1210 to 1270.
Tosus Ivru means?
Tosus Ivru, there was a yeshiva in Ivru, it was a city in Normandy. And Rav Moshe Berub Schneer and his brothers were the Rosh Yeshiva there.
Rabbi Yehuda
and Rabbi Chil from Paris had a school of Bali Tosus, a yeshiva ke'ilu in Paris.
Called Tosus Ivru.
No, they're not Tosus Ivru. They are Rabbi Yehuda, they are more standard. The Tosus Ivru had their own school of Bali Tosus in Ivru, and they were much less standard. And the most prominent known Talmud of Tosus Ivru is Tosus Rabbeinu Peretz. Tosus Rabbeinu Peretz, I'm sure we're familiar with Tosus Rabbeinu Peretz.
Yes.
Psachim, Tosus Rabbeinu Peretz. Okay. Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz, as you may note,
he came from Ivra.
He learnt in Ivra by the Tosfos Ivra. He died. The Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz died around 1300. What? The Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz died around 1300. I don't know why the Tosfos say Ivra are less popular, and the Shem Gedom doesn't even mention them. And you know, and over here in the Rishonim, he gives them very, very little space. The facts are is that the Tosfos Ivra were ki'ilu more radical ki'ilu than the Tosfos Rabbi Chil and Rabbi Chil from Paris. Rabbi Chil from Paris are more or less going with the earlier Bali Tosfosim. Additions, slight changes, the Tosfos Ivra, Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz, but you'll see it more. You see it more in the other ones, but you see it in you know, Psachim, Yevamos, Baba Kama. They can make major conceptual revisions in sugyas, different than the original Balik Tosfosim. Yeah, in other words, we have the original Balik Tosfosim are Rabbeinu Tam, the Ri, and the Rash. They like set down the basic approach. Now it's not what Rabbeinu Tam, the Ri Azaken, Bizak Azaken, and the Rash Mishans. We spoke about them like 5-6 weeks ago. They're the original Bali Tosfosim. They set down the basic approach. Now it's not that Tosfos Avro came up with something completely new, because it's true, it's not completely new. But what I mean is the conclusions of the Ri and the Rash, which Rabbeinu Yechiel and Rabbeinu Yehuda from Paris are usually going to work with, the Tosfos Avro are much more likely to make substantial revisions and changes and argue on them.
What does that mean? Substantial revisions.
That means, in order to understand this, you have to learn really, you know, as I say. So now, why am I saying this? Because I saw a comment that the early Bali Tosfosim had like, you know, real intellectual creativity. And the later Bali Tosfosim lost the intellectual creativity. And it's just absolutely not true. It's absolutely not true. I mean, I don't even say that the Rabbeinu Yechiel from Paris and Rabbi Yehuda from Paris lost their intellectual creativity. I saw this mamash not true. But if you want me to disprove it, I'm going to disprove it from Tosfos Ivra, who spends most of a large amount of the time rejecting what the earlier Bali Tosfosim said. The point is, though, the only way to really understand this and know this is if you learn Be'ilun extensively for years, then you'll be able to see, you know, to someone who has not learned Be'ilun, they won't say, yeah, come on, it just says this, he says this, he says that. There's really a difference? Yeah, there's really a difference. There is a difference. Trust me, I've learned Punti Yasugi is quite Be'ilun, and there's no question, whoever learns Yevamos next year really Be'ilun, Well, hopefully, I don't know, the truth is the first time, I don't know if you'll be able to do it. The first time you have to get down the main way to do it. Afterwards, you can start trying to figure out where you argue with what the more traditional approach is. But you'll see, if you when you learn in the Sanctified like Yevamos Be'ilun, and you see the amount of major substantial differences between Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz and Yevamos, there's like conflicting schools of Bali Tosfosim. But you only see that if you learn a Be'ilun. The problem is there are very few historians who've ever learned Yevamos Be'ilun.
There are very few people who've learned Yevamos, let alone Be'ilun.
No, that's not true. That's not true. Many people have learned Yevamos. Many people have learned Yevamos. But it's a hard mesechta. It's great.
Very few people want to really Be'ilun.
That's not true. That's not true. That's mamish not true. Yes, that's not true. Definitely true. Now we'll schmooze about that later. But anyway, the point is that in order to pick up the aliveness and the creativity of the later Bali Tosfosim, it takes a much deeper level of penetration of Torah, which, in my personal opinion, most historians aren't aware exists. Fine. Okay, I'd kind of guys.